Today we're going to be looking at two chapters in Zechariah, chapters 7 and 8. And there are some very interesting passages in here again because the Lord is walking his people through some pretty heavy discussions. And the first subtitle you see there at the top of the page, we're talking here about windows of opportunity that can slam shut. And that's such a strange thing. We tend to think that everything that the Lord offers us today is a standing offer. And it will always be there as a standing offer. If we say no, it's okay, we can come back later and take a second shot at it. And you know, nothing else in life is really like that. We sometimes recall opportunities that came to us. You know, once upon a time, I could have done such and such a thing, but I said no, and then I went back later, and it was already sold. It was already offered to somebody else. The scholarship program no longer exists, whatever we're talking about. And that's how it is in God's administration, too. So this is a little bit of a difficult passage because they're talking about different celebrations that aren't necessarily at our fingertips. So let me just kind of walk you through the text. And remember, we're going to talk about opportunities that come on wheels and wings, and then they're gone, and we don't have the opportunity anymore. I've printed most of the text for you from chapter 7, verse 1. Came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius. So that's 518. You have to remember that we just studied all those night visions that took place 2 years earlier in 520. We're right in between that at the beginning of the night visions. All the visions came in one night. And the rebuilding of the temple, the completion of that, that's 516. So that's our time frame. And back to the italics. The word of the Lord came unto Zechariah. When the people had sent unto the house of God their men to pray before the Lord and to speak unto the priests and to the prophets, saying, should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these many years? So in the fifth month, they had a tradition that they had been fasting. The question to Zechariah is, should we still be doing this fasting in the fifth month? In the fifth month, because it was in the fifth month of 586 that the temple was destroyed. So they commemorated that with a fast. And the word is, should we continue doing this? Verse 4. Then came the word of the Lord of hosts unto me, saying, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth month and the seventh month. Oh, so there's another fast in the seventh month. We see there in the brackets the explanation. That was the month when Gedaliah, friend of Jeremiah, was assassinated. So in that turbulent period of time, we have Israel losing the war. We have a nice Jewish governor is in place of a king because the king has lost the war. He's assassinated. So lots of troubles. So we're talking about a fast in the fifth month and a different fast in the seventh month. So the Lord says, when you fasted in the fifth month and the seventh month, and back to italics, did you really at all fast unto me, even to me? Were you doing this for me? And when you did eat, and when you did drink, celebrating, when you did eat and when you did drink, did you not eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves? So even the fasting wasn't particularly interesting to the Lord. I mean, there was certainly nothing wrong in mourning the destruction of Solomon's temple. That makes sense in the fifth month if you want to do that. That's fine every year, the month of May for us, if we had a fast. There's nothing wrong with that. But the Lord said, did you really do that for me? I mean, I didn't say you had to fast, and it's okay that you do fast, but were you doing that for me? Or were you just showing off? Obviously, the Lord is asking that because they were showing off. So, verse 7, should you not hear the words which the Lord hath cried by the former prophets when Jerusalem was inhabited in prosperity and the cities thereof round about her, when men inhabited the south and the plain, they're just Jewish people everywhere and prospering, wouldn't it have been better for you to listen to me in those days and then you wouldn't have to do all these fasts? But since you didn't listen to me in those days, then Solomon's temple was destroyed, the king was ousted, a governor set up, the governor assassinated, all that because you didn't listen to me in the first place. I wish you would have obeyed because obeying is better than fasting. Well, so it says in verse 9, execute true judgment, show mercy and compassions every man to his brother, and oppress not the widow, the orphan, fatherless, the stranger, the poor, And let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your heart. You know, that's what I want you to do. Fasting is okay, but that's what I want you to do. I want you to be truly good people. We're not just interested in a lot of ceremonies, and we're not interested in a lot of self-suffering. That's not the point. The point is to obey. Don't show off. Obey. Verse 11. But historically, they, the Jewish people, refused to listen. They pulled away the shoulder. They stopped up their ears, put your fingers in your ears, that they should not hear. Yea, they made their hearts as an adamant stone. You have a cold stone heart. Lest they should hear the law, the words of the Lord of hosts, and because they didn't, the destruction of Jerusalem came. So verse 13, therefore it has come to pass that as God once cried and they would not hear, so the Jewish people cried, and I will not hear, saith the Lord of hosts. But I scattered them with a whirlwind among all the nations whom they knew not. So that's the captivity, people fleeing for their lives in Egypt and Babylon, whatever. Thus the land was desolate after them, that no man passed through nor returned, for they laid the pleasant land desolate. So the Lord is saying, I see all of this religious stuff that you're doing, but I don't really care so much about the religious stuff. I care about obedience. And he said, and I was giving you a chance to obey because I kept calling out to you and I'd send these prophets to you and you wouldn't pay attention to them. Well, then the Babylonians start to siege the city. You're under attack and you start calling out to me. But when I called out to you, you didn't pay attention. So now you're calling out to me in prayer and I'm not going to pay attention. And because of that evolution, that cycle, we have what we have, and all this talk about the fall of Jerusalem, the fall of the temple, Gedaliah being assassinated, and all these fasts. If you just listened to me in the first place, this never would have been necessary. So you see the bulleted point there. As the Lord through his prophets cried and they would not hear, so they cried and I would not hear. It's a reminder that a particular mercy or grace from God might come to us as not as a standing offer, but as a window of opportunity. And you must always remember that if you have been disobedient in times past and you've missed some of the Lord's nice opportunities, you may not be able to get those back. But start where you are now. These people are rebuilding the Holy Land. They're back in Jerusalem again. And the Lord is telling them, I hope that you've learned something. So the important thing is not all of these fasts, but the important thing now is that you're going to obey going forward. So that's the issue in Zechariah's day and, of course, in our day as well. If we won't do that, then opportunities come to us on wheels and wings, and then they're withdrawn, and you never have a second chance at some of those things. That doesn't mean the Lord's not gracious and isn't going to give you more opportunities. But never thumb your nose at the opportunities that God gives you. Obey him when you can, because those opportunities are not always standing offers. Does that raise any questions or observations? I wonder, most of us are not tempted to fast over much, to be noticed. But there might be certain things that we choose to do religiously instead of recalibrating our lives as the Lord would have us do. Suggestions about what we might do religiously that would be the equivalent to fasting instead of recalibrating and obeying. And Desi had a remark. Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah. Desi is saying, because Satan appears as an angel of light, sometimes some really nice offers seem to come to you, but they might not actually be good for you. You know, for example, I have the ability to take this job. It's going to pay a whole bunch more, but I'm going to travel all the time to do it. So I'm so thankful for this opportunity. And now you're going to travel all the time and be away from your family and make a lot more money, but you can't be involved in church and you can't take care of your family. So was that an opportunity from God or from the devil? And how do you tell? And, you know, this is very, very personalized, Desi. So I don't think there's any one formula you can use, but I still think that the Lord is going to use the peace of God that passes all understanding, by and large, to lead us. So you want to confer with the Bible. Does the Bible say anything in particular about this offer? I was reading, who said that? I was reading, maybe Andy Stanley. But he said recently, two men had approached him on the subject of leaving their wives, and their idea was that the Lord was leading them to leave their wives. And he said, let me assure you, that is not what the Lord is leading you to do. And yet they were praying about that, and he said, do not pray about that. The Lord has already answered that. So sometimes the Lord has given us the answer to the situation, but oftentimes we're dealing with things that aren't addressed directly in the Bible. So if the Bible addresses it, case closed. The issue is solved. If the Bible doesn't address it, then you're going to fall on the peace of God that passes understanding. That's why we're praying about this. We want to have a sense of His joy in the decision we're making and Him communicating that joy. And you want the same sense in the people that you know, the Christians around you. So if you have godly individuals around you and they're praying about that and they think, yeah, you know, that really resonates with me too, that makes sense, then that's what we're looking for. And remember, as always, God is not trying to trick you. So that's the most important thing. He's not going to say, there, I got you. See, He is trying to lead you. And so you need not worry that the Lord is trying to make the subtleties, the nuances such that you'll blow it. He's not trying to make you blow it. He's trying to give you your leading in time. And if you have a heart for God, take your best guess, and I think when you go to heaven someday, you're going to find out you nailed it. Good idea. Well done. Joanne. Yeah, sometimes to fill your schedule with stuff, even good Christian stuff, can be a trap. You're doing that because you're noticed at church, and you're kind of a big fish in a little bowl, and because you want to impress the Lord. And the Lord doesn't really necessarily want you to do all that. The Lord want you to obey. And there may be part of that that is obedience and part of that that you kind of launched out on your own on that one. The Lord didn't particularly want you to do that. If I can just interject a little story here. Once again, I think you all know that I dearly love my parents. They're wonderful, but they were new Christians. Remember, they're saved when I'm 2 years old. So, and I was saved at 5 years old. So I'm like catching up with them, you know, we're all doing this together. And, in my home church, I don't know why it was like this, but in my home church, the thinking tended to be that if you are really going to live for Jesus, you're going to be at the church property a whole lot. I mean, a lot. Of course, three services on Sunday, and then we had Awana on two different nights. So Monday is girls' club, and Mom led Awana girls. Thursday is boys' club, and of course, Dad led some of the boys, and he drove the bus for both nights. So that's all day Sunday, Monday evening. Tuesdays tended to be off, but one Tuesday a month was the board meeting, and Dad was always on the board. So one Tuesday a month, Dad goes to a board meeting. Wednesday is prayer meeting. Thursday, again, back to boys' club. Fridays could be fellowships at church or a lot of other things. Saturdays, we didn't tend to do anything particularly at the church property, but then you're back to Sunday again. And really, we were like machines. We're just going and going and going. And then when I got to be about 14 or 15 years old, I started making these crummy decisions with my life. And all of a sudden, Mom and Dad didn't approve. It was really the summer that I turned 15. Mom and Dad didn't approve. And I remember being so surprised, like, you're never even in my life. And all of a sudden, you're on me, like, micromanaging. Like, well, where were you for the last 14 years? Suddenly, you're on me. You know, what is all of this? And I didn't ever resent that we were doing so much with the church. I was just genuinely surprised that Mom and Dad were trying to get back in my life all of a sudden. I didn't feel like they were in my life. And I don't think necessarily that they needed to do all of that. I don't know what fraction they should not have done, but that's rough sometimes. Sharla. Yeah, in this day and age, what percentage of people are spending too much time at church? You're like, well, I don't know if I've met very many of those. Then you go the other way. You think, well, we're all about family, family, family. Never forget, a mafia don loves his family. So it's not like, oh, you know, I'm amazing because I love my family. So does Guido, you know, he loves his family too. Everybody loves his family. We're saying, are you big enough to love somebody who's not in your family? Now that's a museum piece today. Tom, and then I'll come back to Josiah. I'm sorry, Josiah, I forgot you. Yeah, if you can hear Tom, he's talking about the performance orientation of, being in the church worship service and playing the music or singing the music, and it looks like you're very, very spiritual. You must be very devoted to the Lord, but where's the reality behind it? So, you know, it's like the fasting that was show-offish, and so also can the whole music ministry be show-offish, and the substance behind the performance is not so good. Very good. Josiah. Yeah, very good. Yeah, so Josiah is saying that anything we do out of routine and duty and maybe even guilt, even if it's for the Lord, we need to reevaluate that and make sure, you know, are we really doing this out of obedience and a heart for God, and not just be chugging through, you know, soldiering on because somebody said we really need to do this. That's really right. James, very good. Yeah, so the whole missions thing is really tricky. I mean, you have the short-term mission trend, which is nice, you know, it has a lot of value. But a lot of times you have very worldly kids who get excited about going to Haiti to build some kind of a structure. And then they come back and they were worldly before they left and they're worldly when they come back. But in the middle, they said, I did a short-term mission project for the Lord and I was extraordinary. Like, I don't think that's exactly how that's supposed to work. And so you have to be really careful. It's been an interesting thing to me to watch over the years when a church is dying, when it's going away because they've no longer attracted young people, that sort of thing. They do two things out of desperation. The first thing they do is build a gym, hoping that that'll bring young people in, and it never does. I mean, you have to build a gym because you have young people, not to get young people. And the second thing they do is have a monstrous missions program. They're just dumping tons and tons of money into missions, but the church is dying otherwise. And so sometimes it's like, hey, we're a great missions church. Like, well, I'm really glad that you're dumping a ton of money into missions, but you know, there are like a whole lot of people around you that you're supposed to be reaching in your community, and you can't substitute the one for the other. I mean, we really want international missions, but that's not instead of, that's also. And if the, you know, I always say, if you kill the mother, that is the local church, then the baby dies too. Those are the little churches out there that the missionaries are supposed to be working with. If you kill the mother, the baby dies too. So make sure that you have a healthy mom. And that includes doing your duty right here where you live and not just sending money so somebody else does the job. So that's very important. Sometimes missions is held up as an instead of godliness. And it can be a little show-offish. You know, do you realize how much money we're giving to missions? Do you realize how few people you're inviting to church? I think it's supposed to be both, right? So, anyway, opportunities. The Lord said, remember when you were supposed to be recalibrating, adjusting your life? But you didn't adjust your life. So now you're doing all these fasts to show that you have recalibrated. Let's just make sure that this is a true recalibration. You've adjusted your life, and this question about fasting, that's secondary. Let's make sure that you're really obeying. You're listening to me this time, and that's always a good idea. Chapter 8, verse 3 and following is very interesting. We're talking about what might be called Jewish supremacy in the end times. Don't forget that God has his chosen people, even in what we call the millennium, and that's what this is all about. The Lord himself is Jewish. He's reigning in Jerusalem, the most important city in the most important nation on earth. And many passages in the Old Testament talk about how the Jewish people are going to conquer their enemies. And this is one of those texts. So Zechariah chapter 8, verse 3, thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Remember, that's not Sandusky, Ohio. That's Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth. And the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country. I put a little note there. That's kind of interesting that the Lord would talk about saving them from the West country. Because if you're in Israel, the only thing truly west of you is the Mediterranean Sea. Unless you go way, way west and you'll run into the Greek peninsula and the Italian peninsula. So that's really interesting that he says he's going to save them from the West country. That reminds us that that prophecy would have been easy to fulfill in Jesus' day, for example, because you have the Roman Empire, that's Italy, out west, and the Romans were hard on the Jewish people. And so he said he's going to save his people and bring his people from those areas, and that would fit very nicely in the Roman Empire, the first century, not so much in Zechariah's day. And of course, it fits very, very nicely today. And so you can see how that prophecy would be fulfilled nicely in Jesus' day or in our time. Much harder to fulfill it in Zechariah's time. Verse 8, I will bring them, they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, they shall be my people, I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. But now I will not be unto the residue of this people as in the former days, saith the Lord. The seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give her fruit. You just see like an agricultural paradise happening here. The ground shall give her increase, the heaven shall give their due. I will cause a remnant of this people to possess all these things. It shall come to pass that as you were a curse among the heathen, O house of Judah, house of Israel, so will I save you. You shall be a blessing. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, that's Nebuchadnezzar's siege of Jerusalem, the fast of the fifth month, that's the same one we talked about before, the fall of Jerusalem, the fast of the seventh month, as a sorrowful commemoration of when the good governor, friend of Jeremiah, was killed, and the fast of the tenth month, that's commemorating the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's attack on Jerusalem again. All of these fasts shall now be to the house of Judah joy and gladness and cheerful feasts. We're not going to have to fast anymore. Now we're going to feast instead of fast. Therefore, love the truth and righteousness. So you can see that the Lord is not so interested in the fasting as he is interested in the obedience and in the cheerful relationship that we can have with him. The Lord doesn't want us just to serve him out of duty. I'm guilted into doing this. I just have to do it. The Lord wants us to serve him because we want. We love him. We want to do something nice. It's like, okay, well, I guess if my wife really needs a kiss, I'll give her a kiss. Come over here, honey. That's like, who would want that? So, well, you know, it's my duty. I'm a husband. I have to give her a kiss. No, no, no. We want you to want to do these things for the Lord. So we have a couple bulleted points there. First one, proper fasting sacrifices for the Lord are a pleasure, not a drudgery. We'll do this because we love the Lord. And right down to, you know, if you serve in the nursery, don't do it out of guilt and think, oh, it's a drudgery. Do it because those are nice little children in there. The little lambs of the flock need attention. You're allowing some mother and father to be in the service and know that everything's okay with their children. Don't hate that. That's a chance for you to serve the Lord and say, Lord, I'll do this for these people. I'm glad to do it. So proper fasting and all these sacrifices that we do, it ought to be a pleasure. And that's what the Lord is looking for. He is more glorified when we say, I love to watch those little children in the nursery. Then, oh, it's my duty. I've been guilted into it. That Amy won't leave me alone, so I guess I'll do it. Yeah, so Amy said that guilt is a good motivation with her, if that's what it takes. So, but do it for Jesus and love it and don't hate it, and that's what the Lord is looking for. I also put the bulleted point there with a long list because we've run into this couplet again that we like so much in verse 19, which is on the flip side of your page. The Lord is once again saying, love the truth and peace. And this is that amazing couplet that we find really everywhere in Scripture, but more in the New Testament even than in the Old Testament. It just defines how life is supposed to be. So I've given you the list there to remind you how these kinds of truths are coupled together over and over again. In Hosea 12:6, therefore turn to thy God, keep mercy and judgment, and wait on thy God continually. So the verbiage is a little different, but you see there's one that's cold and hard, truth. And then there's one that's gentle, the gentler virtues, peace. We want truth and peace. And the Lord says, love truth. You want the cold, hard facts. You want to love truth. You hate deception, but you love truth. And then, having loved truth, you also love peace. And in Hosea, we want judgment, you know, the cold, hard truth. But we also want mercy. And the proper Christian personality has stitched those together in such a way that they dominate every relationship we have, every thought that we have. Truth, I want the cold, hard truth. And I also love mercy. I love peace. The Psalm 85 text, mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed one another. I love that. Mercy and truth, cold, hard truth, and yet a soft heart of compassion. Mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace. Righteousness, we want the truth. We want what's right. Righteousness and peace have kissed one another. I just love that. In Psalm 89, justice and judgment are the habitation of thy throne. Mercy and truth shall go before his face. Psalm 98:3, he has remembered his mercy and his truth. Psalm 100, verse 5, his mercy is everlasting. His truth endures to all generations. Psalm 115, thy mercy and thy truth's sake. That's why we are giving glory to God. Proverbs 16, verse 6, by mercy and truth, iniquity is purged. Micah 6, 8, what does the Lord want? He wants you to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. John 1:14, what is Jesus like? He is full of grace and truth. And it's always the cold, hard truth and righteousness plus peace and mercy, all welded into one Christian personality. And that's why the motto of our church is conservative Christianity with the spirit of grace. Conservative, that cold, hard truth, righteousness, we stand for it till we die. So conservative Christianity with the spirit of grace, full of grace and truth. We want both welded into one church, welded into one personality, so that we never flinch at the truth or righteousness. You know, we stand steadfastly. But while never flinching at those things, our hearts are soft and tender. We want to extend mercy to people. We want the Lord to extend mercy to us. And so that's why it is in our church motto. That's why it should be, you know, in our hearts to have these all welded together. Mercy and truth, mercy and righteousness, peace and righteousness, however you're going to say it. The cold, hard, righteous truth and endless compassion, peace. That's the proper Christian life. All right. So one more text on this idea of the Jewish supremacy, the Jewish dominance in the end times. And this is one of the most unusual and extraordinary passages on this subject in the entire Bible. It's striking to read. So chapter 8, verse 21. And the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to pray before the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. And of course, we've been in the subject of Jerusalem this whole time. So other cities are going to say, let's go and visit Jerusalem and worship. So in verse 22, and not only the Jewish people, but many people in strong nations, so not the Jewish nation, many people in strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. This is nations, entire Gentile nations. You know, the representatives of all of these nations are eager to come and worship in Jerusalem. Verse 23, thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days, and remember, whenever you see that term, in those days, in that day, in the day of the Lord, you think, oh, I wonder if this is talking about the tribulation and millennium, because most times it is. In those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nation. So these are 10 Gentile guys. 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of the nations. Even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we've heard that God is with you. That is extraordinary. For one thing, does it bother you that the men are wearing skirts? I always think that's so funny when you're in a legalistic church and say, well, the women have to wear skirts and the men can't wear skirts. Like, oh no, because in the millennium, all these guys are wearing skirts. So all of these Gentile nations are going to grab hold of the skirt of a Jewish guy and they're going to say, oh, you're Jewish? Cool. Can I go worship with you? We've been eager to go worship the Lord in Jerusalem, but can I go with you? Because I've heard that God is with you Jewish people. So can I go worship with you? In our bulleted points, the paradise-like conditions of chapter 8 have never been seen in history. This has never played out, that entire nations have grabbed hold of the Jewish people and said, can I please go worship with you today? That has never happened, not by a country mile. The prophecy cannot be in error. It's not like Zechariah really missed the boat. Like, Zach, what were you thinking? There's no way that this is ever going to happen. Sure, it's going to happen. We're just dealing with something that's future even to our generation. So it will come to pass. And the second bullet point there says, Gentile worshipers in the millennium acknowledge that the Jewish people have more status in Messiah's kingdom than they do. And they are eager to stay in the good graces of the Jewish worshipers. And I am noticing here that this is very, very different from the current church age, in which the Lord has no difference between Jews and Gentiles, circumcision or uncircumcision. When the rapture occurs, you are starting a new chapter in the Lord's administration, the tribulation of millennium, together when he starts to deal in a very special way with the Jewish nation. And in the millennium, of course, we're glorified, so this is not a text for us, but these would be for our ancestors who survive into the millennium. They're going to think, wow, those Jewish people, they're wonderful. They're extraordinary. And that's the way Abraham's promise began back in the book of Genesis. I am going to bless them that bless you and curse those that curse you. And the family of Abraham is going to get its paradise just like all the prophets promised.